From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we take a look at the situation in Venezuela with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
The fundamental reality is the United States has lost Eurasia, to put it in those crude terms, because it simply can't compete militarily, economically, diplomatically even with Russia and China in the Eurasian lands. And when Trump came to power, he took the decision to drop out of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which opened the door for Japan, for example, to play a more important role. And perhaps in some ways, Japan was a proxy for the United States in that sense. But what has actually happened is that there seems to be a strong recognition of the East Asia, Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia's self-interest. You know, you've got South Korea trying to reach a stable agreement and end the war that was never the war. They never signed a peace with North Korea, right?
Right.
So you've got South Korea trying to do that. You've got Japan trying to stabilize its position vis-a-vis China and its neighbors. And that's just an example in another part of the world of the way the United States has lost its power and influence. And although it still has its military power, and that to some extent has been cut down to size, if you like, by the fact that that Russia has new armaments that render, for example, United States carrier forces irrelevant in terms of geopolitical menace, because they just get wiped out if any conflict ever started. But that has been the basis of U.S. power projection for as long as anybody can remember, hasn't it?
Yeah, you know. And so what's interesting about this, by the way, I mean, you mentioned Korea and that. Korea, the southern part of Korea, has essentially been occupied since 1910, since the Japan-Korea Treaty, you know, with Japan occupying it. And we know the history of Japanese occupation of Korea, right, you know, with, you know, murders and rapes and all the horrors of all of that. And then the U.S., this part's not widely known here, but what happened, in essence, when the U.S., got its unconditional surrender from Japan, it essentially took over the bases of occupation in Korea from Japanese. And they essentially became the officer class for the occupying army, and then replaced the people on the ground. And so, and then the same guy who did that, that was Truman, started the war against, you know, to try to recapture the entire peninsula. And there has been no peace treaty since then. And then so you have Japanese and China's and Korea's interests all, you know, being really reoriented to the reality of things there. I think that's just the sheer force of reality pushing, driving events there, and as well as the people of both, you know, parts of Korea. But the U.S. is doing the same thing also. I mean, to me, Venezuela is a lot like Libya was to Africa up until 2011. It was a focal point and a financer of unity, of a development of of a process of integration, sort of a guarantor of independence. The huge role that Libya played in the African Union, for example, in fact, from changing it from the Organization of African States, the OAU, I think it was, to the African Union, and the conceptual changes that with an avowed goal of African integration, pointing towards its own currency. I mean, these are all the kinds of things that Venezuela was talking about at UNASUR only three, four years ago. And they blew Libya into oblivion. And now it's, Venezuela's turn, I think.
And so the reason for us when we're trying to focus on Latin America, to talk about what's happening in Asia, and as you pointed out, in Africa too, is that the United States has taken the decision that it's going to defend its hemisphere, its GAN, and because it can't project its power, its military power, and now even its economic power effectively in the areas where it used to. And so what it's trying to do is to lock down Latin America to make sure that the United States and its ally Canada, of course, have control and access to both the incredibly abundant natural resources in Latin America and the Caribbean, and also a captive pool of cheap labor, so for its corporate interests. So what we're seeing in Venezuela is very much what the United States and its allies were doing in Africa. And looking at it in a global sense, it's not just the United States that is taking this strongly interventionist role in what was always its colonial or neo-colonial backyard, as it were. And if you look at what's happening in West Africa, France, and by extension the European Union, of course, are doing exactly the same thing in West Africa.
Right.
And if you look at the way the destabilization is currently going on in Cameroon, what has happened in Mali,
right,
what has happened in Ivory Coast and Burkina Faso, all the Central African Republic,
right,
all this disruption is the same thing there with the former colonial power France and
right,
its European Union allies, as what we're seeing in Latin America with the United States and its allies targeting Venezuela. And so,
yep,
and the reason to talk about all that more global stuff is because it explains in a global context,
right,
very strongly what is happening in Venezuela, and of course, to
right,
a lesser extent, Nicaragua, and what has been happening to Cuba for the last almost 60 years now.
You know, if you think about the claims, and there was some really amusing conversation, by the way, yesterday, that went on at the State Department press briefing between, I forget the guy that's covering for them now, and Matt Lee from the Associated Press. But it was a big deal that the U.S. press and international press start using the correct terminology towards the person that we call random dude, Guaido, that he's not self-appointed president and he's not something else, but that he's the interim president, that he's the constitutional president, etc. But the whole idea that this is some sort of, democratic exercise, replacing an elected president from afar, when you tie it into the international scene, it takes you back to Cote d'Ivoire and the removal of that elected president at gunpoint by French troops, by the colonial troops.
Yeah, and then the murder of Gaddafi in Libya.
Yeah, which was invoked by some of the characters, including Marco Rubio a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, as an explicit threat towards Maduro.
Yeah, what's interesting is that you and I had this conversation, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and we more or less agreed that we didn't really think that, although a military intervention is always possible, it's much more likely that the United States would maintain its war of attrition against Venezuela, very much as it did against Nicaragua in the 1980s,
right,
and when after 10 years of exhausting war and economic sanctions, there was an election in Nicaragua, and people voted for the U.S. candidate because they were just exhausted.
Right.
And I think that is the U.S. game plan in Venezuela, with the constant threat, of course, of hanging over people in Venezuela, which is part of the psychological warfare, part of the psychological abuse, this mass psychological abuse that the United States engages in,
right,
consistently against its target regimes.
Right.
That's what happened in Nicaragua. In Nicaragua, people were constantly prepared. I remember being in Nicaragua at the time, and there were constant exercises by the People's Militia preparing for a possible invasion.
This was, you know, this is a psychological warfare, you know, aside from actual warfare, this is, you know, it's a terrorist campaign in essence, with the biggest terrorist in the world.
And you mentioned Ivory Coast, but we have to look back to Angola and Mozambique, what the United States and its racist apartheid allies in South Africa did to both those countries, via the respective armed groups, RENAMO in Mozambique and UNITA and others in Angola, and that's we're likely to see that in Venezuela. We're likely to see armed incursions from Colombian territory, and it's clearer than ever now that the whole point of the peace negotiation under Juan Manuel Santos, the former Colombian president, was to eliminate
the FARC guerrilla, to disarm them
as a possible player that might interfere with Colombian army and Colombian paramilitary incursions into Venezuela.
Let me ask you this, because you're invoking the situation in Nicaragua back in the 80s and 90s as a as an antecedent, perhaps, or certainly as a study. And so what ended up happening, the people were exhausted from this, you know, terror campaign that lasted from the first day of the revolution, essentially, until the election of Violeta Chamorro. That's what you're referring to, right? And then what happened? What happened, in essence, was not so far afterwards, once the jackboots were pulled off the corners or whatever, went out and voted the Sandinistas back into power. And at the time, you know, Honduras went from being the staging area for the Contra War to electing Mel Zelaya. So you have, you know, these kinds of things that, you know, history doesn't stop. Looking at South America specifically, as opposed to Central America 20, 30 years ago, Brazil is, you know, ready to go at the drop of a match. And the conditions in Brazil resemble those in Venezuela tremendously, even more pressure applied to them. You have a large indigenous and African descended population that have been deprived of everything for centuries, who finally get to participate in the body of politic, get some actual share of the economy. And they stripped that away by doing what they did with Rousseff, and then by doing what they did with Lula. I mean, it was hilarious to hear people lecturing about the validity of the election of Maduro at the UN, the Brazilian representative who was there because Lula was in jail. And I'm wondering if they start a fire in Venezuela, if it's going to it might consume Brazil.
Yeah, and there are very the ridiculous thing about the coverage of Venezuela in mainstream media and in government statements from the European leaders and from North American leaders, and just look at what's happening to Justin Trudeau now, for example, and his corruption is finally being uncovered, and these are the people that talk about, you know, corruption in Venezuela. Ridiculous. But if you look at the region, there are variations on what you've been saying across the region, and so how has the United States managed to control the region without using military force exactly? Well, it's used its control of economic structures, and it's also used its ability to work with local elites with strong concentrations of media power, like you have in Argentina and with Clarín, the Clarín group, and in Chile with the Mercurio group, in Brazil with the El Globo group, and so they combine that media power with their right wing allies' control of judicial instances. And they also work very hard to divide the opposition. So, and if what, but if you, what are the material conditions that you were referring to in relation to Brazil or in the region generally? Well, if you look at Argentina now, and poverty is up around 50%,
right?
And a large number of people are only eating one meal a day. I find that there was a report on television last night about the situation in Argentina. So, Macri got into power, President Mauricio Macri got into power by lying to people that his right. neoliberal policies would bring prosperity and to Argentina.
Right.
And of course, the reverse has happened.
Right.
And when, going back to 1990 election, all the promises here in Nicaragua was of wonderful prosperity just around the corner, thanks to the right-wing government's adherence to the United States economic model. And the reverse happened. After 16 years of neoliberal politics, people were suffering power cuts of 12 hours a day here in Nicaragua.
Right.
Even the big private business sector were craving a Sandinista win, because that would bring them some relief to their energy problems, because right. because Venezuela at that time, as you pointed out earlier, was a very strong positive influence, galvanizing regional resources for the benefit of people at grassroots. And that was the fundamental contribution of Hugo Chavez following and working together with Fidel Castro from Cuba. That was his fundamental contribution. And that, of course, is why the corporate elites in the United States and Europe detested him.
Right.
Because he made available Latin America's resources for the benefit of the impoverished majority. Look at what's happening in Colombia. In Colombia, in Guajira, dozens of children are dying every week of hunger. That doesn't happen in Venezuela. But Colombia is the country that's accusing Venezuela of inflicting suffering on its people.
Yeah, and delivering humanitarian aid across their bridge.
Yeah, and of course, what wasn't reported was that Venezuela sent some aid to Cucuta.
Right.
Venezuela tried to send some aid to help the people that are dying of hunger in Colombia, and the Colombian government rejected it.
Of course not. Yeah,
which,
right.
So, but of course, that doesn't get reported. Yeah. And there's so much going on in the region that reflects the fact that the United States has a very weak hand. And despite all its military power, despite all its economic power, even the Spanish foreign minister, admitted in an interview that they are under the table dealing directly with the government of President Maduro.
Right.
Because he's the guy that is the legitimate president and actually has control and authority in Venezuela. So even the Spanish government, which is a kind of supine ally of the United States and does whatever the United
right.
States tells it,
right.
even they recognize the reality on the ground.
You know,
let's also look at the whole issue of corruption. Apart from what's happening in Canada with Justin Trudeau and the scandal that he's involved in covering up, or trying to cover up relatively unsuccessfully, and look at what's happening in Argentina and Ecuador. And Lenin Moreno now, Lenin Moreno got into power on a left-wing ticket, on the progressive ticket of the party of Rafael Correa, and then did exactly the opposite. He's actually implementing the economic and political agenda of Ecuador's right-wing opposition that lost the election. Moreno won. And now what's coming out? Now we're discovering that Lenin Moreno has been the beneficiary via an offshore company of a luxury apartment in Spain.
Isn't that amazing how that works?
And so all that's coming out now. And what he's now done a deal with the IMF for a relatively paltry sum given the size of the Ecuadorian economy.
Right.
But on the basis of that agreement, he's now sacked something like 10,000 public workers in the space of 3 days. So what does that mean? What that means is that the neoliberal model peddled by United States proxies like Lenin Moreno and like Mauricio Macri, like Jair Bolsonaro and like Sebastián Piñera, it's coming apart at the seams. It just doesn't hold, because the reality for ordinary people is inescapable for ordinary people.
And that's the kernel. That's the kernel of the demise of it.
They can't live on the kind of rhetoric coming out of their right-wing political leaders' mouths.
Yeah, they need food.
That is the United States' fundamental weakness. Weakness in Venezuela.
It's the weakness across the board with that whole position. And, you know, we've been saying for years in our conversations, basically, you got China's model, win-win, and you've got the U.S. model, which is we're going to take all your stuff, basically, and which one is sustainable and which one is not. What you have, a couple of things on display with respect to Venezuela, and one became a little more apparent to me. I did a crosstalk with RT last week as one of the guests, and it was about Venezuela. And one of the guests was Isaac Nahan Sarfati, who is an academic at some Canadian university. He is from Venezuela, and he reminded us a couple of times that his grandmother still lives in Caracas. And he conveyed, in essence, as an adherent, the rhetoric of the right. This is the stuff that's on, you know, the TV stations, all the private TV stations down there that they're trying to sell to the people. And that was, he blames Maduro and socialism for those 12 hours of there being no power in Caracas. You know, the whole economic crisis is a product of corruption and socialism inherent, contradictions. And so, you know, obviously their strategy is the same thing that was used in Nicaragua. People, after a while, don't really care what the cause is. They feel the pain all the time. What button do I push to make it stop? And so electing Violeta Chamorro, regardless of whatever the logic is to you or whatever, if that's going to make the pain stop, then that's what we'll do. And that's kind of what the effort is behind, you know, this all the starving of Venezuelans, to create enough pain to create that kind of dissonance among the population so that they'll, you know, acquiesce if not actively revolt. But now, hold on, because here's the point of that. It was kind of a long piece of context. The actual effort here has been, and the measure of Maduro's power has been, whether or not the military will stay loyal to the government. This is what they keep spewing here. They have like almost like a scoreboard with that. And what they don't mention is that the military was a part of a coup now it's 17 years ago, okay? And the people undid that coup. And the polling data right now says across the board, even including the people who support the opposition, they do not want foreign military or other intervention in determining their fate. 86%. So the strategy is a dead end.
No, and the United States strategy is not working, and it's not going to succeed. And that's, I may be wrong about that, but that's how I feel at the moment, given all the information available.
Yep.
Because what you just pointed out is a very strong fundamental reality. Even people who may not be Chavista are Bolivarian in the sense that
that's right.
They value the heritage of Simón Bolívar as Venezuelans, and they aren't going to let the Colombian right wing invade with impunity their country, their society, their economy. Then, and they're certainly not going to let the gringos do it, the Yankees. They're not going to let the United States do it.
I mean, even the OAS headquarters in Washington is named after Bolívar.
So if you look at the U.S. strategy, can we talk? Do we have a little bit of time to talk about Nicaragua in this context?
We've got 3 minutes.
Okay, so, and what's happened in Nicaragua? We just had elections in Nicaragua on the Caribbean coast in which something like 420,000 people were entitled to vote. Usually the turnout in those Caribbean coast elections is around 40 to 45%. This time around it was something like 46%, which is good for given the history of those elections. The elections were for 90 seats in the Caribbean coast autonomous regional assembly, and because in Nicaragua around 33% of Nicaragua's national territory is owned under common title by the indigenous peoples of the country, and those indigenous peoples have their own autonomous regime in all along the Caribbean coast, and that's what the elections were about. Out of those 90 seats, 63 or 64 will go to candidates of the FSLN following those election results,
yeah.
Right? Now, this is the country where it's supposed to be a dictatorship.
Right.
Okay. They just held elections. Right. There were nobody inside Nicaragua is claiming, and certainly none of the 19 political parties participated in those elections. None of those parties are claiming, making any claims of fraud. Okay?
Right.
So, All nonsense, all the corporate lies, all the insidious attempts to paint the Sandinista government as a bloodthirsty dictatorship last year. People are still saying, for example, that Daniel Ortega was responsible for 300 deaths by security forces.
Right.
It's a downright lie.
I know.
And the most of the deaths were caused by the opposition. And the total number of deaths around 270, and you can argue about whether 40 protesters died or 60 protesters died, but the fundamental nitty-gritty is the opposition was responsible for most of the violence. And these elections on the Caribbean coast just bear that out. Just the week before the elections, there was an opinion poll published by the very well-respected kind of centrist M&R polling company, and that showed that currently the government has around 54% of support for its policies, and the personal approval of Daniel Ortega is still around 60%, you know, which is dramatically lower than it was before when he was up around 80%, but that's after all the events of last year and the endless psychological warfare to which the government here has been subject. So, and that why is that relevant for Venezuela? Because it just shows that the underlying reality doesn't change. The United States and its media allies and its NGO network and the corrupt human rights institutions in the Organization of American States and the United Nations, which actually the office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is in conflict with the special rapporteurs that are named by the Geneva-based United Nations Human Rights Council.
Yep.
So all that propaganda, all that model of psychological warfare does not change the underlying reality.
That's absolutely right.
And that is why the United States is going to lose in Venezuela.
Right.
It's what we said last time. What kind of defeat will the United States suffer in Venezuela? We're slowly seeing the shape of what that defeat is going to look like.
I agree. And, you know, this is one of the things that apparently gets lost on these people here who are used to being able to sway public opinion with their monopoly control of the media. But when people used to live outdoors or in tin cans and they suddenly have an apartment and now someone wants to evict them from the apartment, they understand exactly what's happening no matter what their television tells them. And this is the case in Venezuela for 2.5 million families, 2.5 million households, because that's how many apartments were built by the revolution in a country with a population of about 25 million. In other words, for about 1 in 10 of the people there was a new apartment built. We got to stop right here. We're done, and I appreciate your time, and we'll speak with you again next week.
Thanks a million, Don.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.